Everybody, we're back on Voices from the Front Lines. This is your host, Eric Mann, and our truly honored guest, Ward Churchill. Thanks, Maggie LaPique, for that new music by Arjun Star. The song is called What's My Indian Name? Maggie LaPique just dreams stuff up as the show goes along. Ward, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, Ward. Just so we know, I have something written out that the production assistant, Lisa Adler, did nicely. It says, I'd like to welcome Ward Churchill to the show. Ward Churchill is professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado, we're not using past tense here, and co-director of the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement. His books include, and I wonder if they took, why, if they had any problems with these books, Ward, Marxism and Native Americans, Struggle for the Land, On the Justice of Roosting Chickens, the COINTELPRO papers, and A Little Matter of Genocide, Holocaust and Denial in the Americas. There's all these different, as it's written here, in June 2006, Ward Churchill was fired by the University of Colorado in response to a statement about September 11th, the decision which the University Board of Regents recently upheld. Now, Ward, I'm going to just throw a couple of things of intro and then throw it back to you, if that's okay. I've been following this case. Natsu Saito, who's Ward's partner, has been doing a lot of great work, and as has Daniel Kim, who's at the University of Colorado at Boulder. This whole thing began, as it did with Amiri Baraka, who was the poet laureate of New Jersey, contradictory concept in itself, and then wrote a poem on September 11th. Ward Churchill was a highly recognized scholar in indigenous affairs, Indian affairs, left politics, anti-imperialist politics, but you wrote something about September 11th, and that September 11th, and the reason I want to go back to that, and if it's okay to deal with the controversial passage, because this whole case is about that. I mean, everything else is a fraud. Everything else was simply investigating you with a preconceived understanding of, you know, what the trial was going to be about, claiming there were problems of academic footnoting. So why don't you tell us about, while they claim this had nothing to do with the First Amendment, and that your whatever you wrote was okay, tell us what you wrote, and tell us what provoked this whole thing.
Well, I wrote during a process, really, of the buildings coming down, that far from being an undefined number, because they didn't know at the point I wrote this how many people had actually been in the buildings, far from there being this undefined number of automatically innocent Americans in there, victimized by some sort of senseless act. That was the framing, that there was really a sort of technocratic core of empire lodged in that building, and that the people who comprised that technocratic core were the moral equivalent, probably the legal equivalent, of Little Eichmann. Little Eichmann's was the key phrase there.
Ward, we're having a lot of trouble with the transcription of with your voice. Are you on a cell?
I'm not. I'm on a landline, but it's remote handheld.
Okay, can you get closer to wherever you got to go? Because what you have to say is so important. It's picking up with a lot of static right now.
Okay. Let me move into another room, which is not necessarily going to be a quiet zone.
Okay.
Let's see if it improves.
Stay right there.
You hear me more?
Yeah, stay right where you are. So you ended, let's go back to the Eichmann reference, because that is what this whole thing is about, and everything else is pretense. So stay with there for a few minutes.
Stay with Eichmann.
Yeah, stay with Eichmann, because you know that's what this is about, so let's not discuss your footnotes, right?
Well, they've actually, in as weird, the way they usually operate is in a totally disingenuous fashion, but to all intents and purposes, they've now admitted the fact that the rest of this stuff was no more than vacuous assertions, because they will not concede that it constituted scholarship and would be subject to scholarly scrutiny and rebuttal. So it's they simply assert these things as being true, and of course the parrots in the mainstream media, including those who purport to be progressive or liberal, repeat that because it's very convenient. But now you've stripped away all the supposed research misconduct charges. It goes right back to where it was at the outset, late January and early February 2005, and what you end up with is you didn't genuflect to the script, if you will, which all three major news feeds on September 11th were coming out that by virtue of being Americans, people who were killed that day were automatically innocent, no matter who they were or how many there were or what they did. That's a given.
Right.
And insofar as that was given, you could not hold them accountable or U.S. policy accountable or U.S. action in the world accountable in any sense at all. You see, I blasphemed at that point. And the whole expectation is that enough pressure could be brought to bear over the process that transpired, or during that process over the past 2 years, that I would in some sense recant and apologize for calling things by their right name as I saw it, and I stand by that.
Well, that's...
If you starve children for a living, if you immiserate brown-skinned children in the third world as a matter of entitlement to yourself for reasons of profit maximization by chaining them to machines and sweatshops, you're the moral equivalent of Adolf Eichmann, period. That's not a equivocal statement, and it's not anything that's especially unusual, if you think about it. Those sorts of terms and analogies get utilized to explain people who behave this way in every corner of the world all the time. Americans take it for granted that people, dictators, so-called totalitarians and so forth, out there somewhere, can be held accountable to some standard of legality, some standard of morality, and so forth. But Americans are automatically exempt from the effects of their actions in the world. And that dog ain't gonna hunt.
Well, that's, I mean, obviously, you know, you missed, not that it was such a great thing to miss, but I did a commentary on Guy Bonds and how watching the witch hunt going after one of the greatest baseball players of all time because he was is an angry black man who will not recant. Glenn Ford, the previous guest, was talking about the breaking of Jack Johnson, the attacks on Paul Robeson. So watching it happen to you, watching the fact, you know, they say the third rail in American politics is Social Security. You got to be kidding. The third rail in American politics is September 11th. You cannot challenge the idea that in September 11th was in any way, it's like watching a movie. Oh, here's a good one. When I was a white kid in Brooklyn, my mom would take me to cowboy and Indian movies. I didn't know, just that was what I was seeing. Every movie started with an Indian scalping a white woman. That's where it started. It was like coming in the middle of a movie, except that's where the movie started, and then everything else was the revenge of the cowboys against the aggressor. It took
Israel-Palestine relation there, the Israelis are always retaliating, killing a few hundred people because they incurred a couple of fatalities as a result of having invaded somebody else's country.
Right. So the question is that if you look at the whole body of your work, from the critique of the master narrative of September 11th, isn't even a more fundamental challenge to you the critique of American genocide and the whole creation of this country as a white settler state, which is the whole basis of your life work?
Well, yeah, correct. But there's a twofold challenge that's in there. It's challenging of the orthodoxy. Challenging of the celebratory interpretation of American history that's been invented by the status quo. That's the mainstream, but it's also a critique, if you think about it, of the framing supplied by the so-called opposition. You never use words like that because it would require a whole line of analysis and response that goes beyond any comfortability, and comfortability is kind of the limit of the opposition. Now, I'm talking broad brushstrokes here. There's clearly exceptions to this. They usually tend not to come from, if, for lack of a better term, and I think it's an appropriate one, however, the mainstream of progressivism or opposition. You end up with somewhat inchoate responses. I mean, you were referred to Jack Johnson and Barry Bonds, and their crime was, you know, they were guilty of being angry while black. And that's the direction it's gone. People on the receiving end in the communities that in a way they represent tend to have a crisper focus because it's a real harshness of context. It's absent in a lot of contexts from the mainstream society. The mainstream society being defined essentially as Euro-specific society. It wants to define everything in those terms. Okay, you get these oppositional groups that are consigned to the fringe even by the opposition and then repudiated and renounced because the mainstream of opposition wants to stay safe and comfortable and morally pure.
Well, let's move on. I want to make sure you get an... that's good. I want to get a couple more things and make sure you score some points you need to. Tell us for a few minutes. We're going to talk about the fact that Wart has, quote, lost his job. We are now in a position of trying to get it back. There's going to be a lot of legal and political fights. We want to make sure there's time for this. But just tell us in 3 minutes, to give him a thing, explain the McCarthyite capitulation of a lot of the professors who fought hard, who gave you lip service around academic freedom. What was it like trying to organize faculty around a very elemental element that a controversial professor was clearly attacked for his views, and yet his whole academic record, an enormous academic record, was subject to the greatest amount of slander under the pretense of bad research methods? What's it been like?
That's the interesting thing. It's somebody who's been involved and seen it clearly and done really solid, sustained work on it has described it in terms of trying to herd jellyfish. That was actually a very astute maneuver on the part of the institutional engineers, if you will, of this whole process. Is that you started with 200 tenured faculty members signing a petition demanding a halt to the process because of the ideal of academic freedom. So they simply sidestepped that and announced these spurious charges on research misconduct, okay, and all of a sudden a thundering silence prevailed, and it's not because necessarily they actually believed that any of this was true. I mean, this process has been transparent enough that if you can tie your shoes in the morning without an instruction manual, you could see through it. But it provided them the cover to run for cover. Now they had the same pretext that was going to be used in court, okay, that allowed them to stand down and not confront the abridgment of academic freedom in a systematic and structural way, the way it was being done. They could pretend it was about something else, and they didn't have to take a position. That's been the sort of progressive response all the way through.
Right, the gutlessness.
Again, we've got clear exceptions. You name some. I could name some more. Tom Mayer would be one. Markey would be one. The local chapter of the AAUP, which is newly formed, oddly enough, has been very clear on this and taken solid positions. There's Eric Mann. Excuse me.
That's all right.
Eric Mann. Eric Chaffetz is who I was trying to reference at Cornell University, and Michael Yellowbird of Kansas, and others. There have been clear exceptions, but exceptions prove rules. And you've got a thundering herd of so-called progressives who are embracing the idea that somebody's footnotes, even if these charges were correct, were sufficient justification for the kind of steps that have been taken there. And they don't happen to be true.
And I know that, and I'm not going to dignify, you know, we're not bringing you on the show to defend footnotes when they're going after you, when they're trying to lynch somebody. We don't go.
Yeah, but that's
no, absolutely, but that's how trivial. Now let's get to the next thing, but it is for the audience to understand. So in the end, after all this, the fight turns out not to be about academic freedom, which a lot of the academics capitulate on, but about research methods and whether or not some of his footnotes were or were not correct. And yeah, that's why they had a 2-year investigation and fired him publicly. So now let's
and
get
then
to...
And refused to defend it.
And then refused to defend it. So given that you are one of the most important indigenous scholars in the country, that you have a body of work that's incredible, where is the struggle now? Where do you want to take it politically? Do you want to keep the fight on? What's the form the fight takes? And again, we're going to ask our listeners to get your pen out and listen, because we got to do something. Ward, where do you think this campaign is going now?
Unfortunately, and I say that because my priorities were never fighting, were never involved with fighting narrow institutional in that particular arena. Nonetheless, this cannot be allowed to pass or stand in its own terms, and so it's necessary to take it to a different court, pun not intended. I meant like basketball court, but literally it is into court, to see if a Denver jury will be as snowed by this kind of nonsense as your average academic on the Boulder, Colorado campus. And I'm obviously betting pretty hard that they won't be.
Well, also, it's very...
If your actual average guy on the street, male, female, whatever community they're coming from, can see that through this in a heartbeat. Or your average academic pretends to be so confused by the complexity of the issues that they just don't know what to do. Okay? So that's one...
And stay a minute there, Ward. What is it? This is Eric Mann. You're on with Ward Churchill. This is Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM. Ward, what are the legal charges? You are bringing suit against the University of Colorado on what grounds?
Well, bringing it basically on First Amendment grounds with additional elements of selective enforcement and defamation, fraudulent defamation, as a matter of fact. I mean, those are clear implications of the case. So you can sort of triangulate. That's the three legs of the stool. That's what we're going to be going into court with. That's a pretty strong hand at this point.
And pretty exciting, don't you think? That, in other words, they think this is over and you've gone away. I mean, just to give you some support, I understand you have other things to do. And maybe on a personal level you think, well, I don't know, this is too much about me. As somebody telling you from the outside, it's very much about you and your whole history and your whole life. But it's also about the movement. They made it about you. So we got to go back in there because you are a symbol of a movement. And I think it's very exciting that you have another case. You know, I think it's exciting that there's another arena to continue this struggle. Tell us about your attorney a little bit, because we're trying to get some money, right, to just get this case going.
Not for the attorney himself. David Lane is top shelf litigator. He's a courtroom attorney and does quite a lot of death penalty work on appeal.
Well, that's probably what you're facing, bro.
Well, in a way, that's analogous. I don't think I literally would choose to trade places with Mumia Abu-Jamal, for example. Okay, but he understands the analogy as well and has made it himself, for which I'm deeply honored and appreciative.
Oh.
But, yeah, we'll fight it out as far as there is to fight it out. And in the end, we're going to win it on those grounds. But that win is also symbolic. We turn symbols to our own advantage, or we let the symbols bury us. And, yeah, I have that symbolic station at present time, but that station really illuminates the situation with Norman Finkelstein, for example. And with Nicholas DeGenova out of Columbia, and with the three guys in Middle East studies that were targeted by Daniel Pipe's organization at Columbia, and with a guy named a professor by the name of Alim at Northeastern University. And we can keep running down the list. There is a general onslaught that's being mounted by organizations like ACTA, like David Horowitz, whatever he's calling it this week, like Daniel Pipe's organization, that are interlocked, acting in concert, and have high Republican officials basically as part of their apparatus, not to mention a good portion of the news media that's cooperating. And what they're looking for is basically to roll up all of the kinds of lines of development in terms of analysis and consciousness that would allow people to respond to the actualities of their situation in real terms rather than what they're fed in institutional context and in media context, respond and change the way things are done here. They're looking to roll that up, take away that sort of point, if you will, of critical interrogation that goes on in the universities and turn the universities, higher educational system in general, into sort of a glorified VOTEP where people receive ideological block instruction that causes them to be accepting of whatever they're asked to do with their technical competence once they've graduated. Not to have cognitive dissonance or problems of consciousness, but to be as efficient and effective as a system wants them to be.
Eventually becoming like little Eichmanns, would you say?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean,
becoming little Eichmanns.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, the thing that's interesting is that when I was an organizer for Students for Democratic Society at Boston University, there were two professors, Howard Zinn and Murray Levin.
Mm-hmm.
Howard had a class of 500 students. Murray had a class of 500 students. I would be brought in as a cool guest lecturer to talk about a campaign against the ROTC, against the BU overseas program, and we would recruit members of Students for Democratic Society out of having the chance to bring an anti-war point of view. We would always, the left's point of view has always been the debate, right? We came up with the idea of debating teach-ins, debating the State Department. We not that we believe in the, you know, the complete free marketplace of ideas, but that's generally been our tactic. So getting rid of Finkelstein, getting rid of you, it means that a whole generation of students don't even get to be exposed to these points of view. That,
the idea.
Right? That, I mean, that it's not even, as you were saying about the dissidents, it's not even they have to agree with you. It's that they're going to go home and say, oh, my God, this is the first time I thought about the genocidal history of the United States. I may not agree with it, but it may, for a lot of people, it will change their minds. So your case takes on an enormous importance. Let's go back to, I understand that your lawyer is not asking for money, but you need money to make filing fees. It still costs a lot of money to get our researchers to, where do they want people to send the money?
Well, there's a website. It's www.wardchurchill.net, and the information is posted on that with regard not only to making contributions for purposes of transcriptions and depositions and possibly private investigators, that sort of thing, not for the attorney himself.
Right, right, I understand that.
Okay. That information is posted on the web. A lot of the history of this in detail, the actual documents are at this point posted, and information as it emerges. Because this is an evolving case, obviously.
That's
the situation's
right.
Not static. Things continue to break with it. So the updates are posted on that.
www.wardchurchill.net. Got
That's
it, folks?
Correct.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, it's exciting. It's a struggle. I think what's great about what you're doing and what your friends are doing in Boulder is you're making this into a campaign. You're continuing it as a campaign, and the, quote, discovery process. What would be some of the things you might discover about the University of Colorado Ward? What are some type of information that the trial might come out that they wouldn't like to come out?
Some clarity with the degree of financial pressure that was exerted and was organized by ACTA and others. This is the tactic they use. And they're thinking, you know, it's very sound in a way. They expect those who are coming out of the institutions with a right-wing perspective, out of business schools and so forth, with a generally right-wing ideological orientation, tend to value making money ahead of other possible life choices, career options, or however you want to put it, whereas people come out with a progressive or oppositional, dissident, critical, all those words would apply, orientation. People with that orientation tend to do things which are, from that perspective at least, socially engaged and constructive, and there's not a lot of money in that. So what they do, ACTA and kindred groups, and by the way, the president of the University of Colorado is one of the founders of ACTA.
Tell us what ACTA is. What?
It's called ACTA. It's the Association of Concerned Trustees and Alumni. It's a hard right-wing organization. It was founded by University of Colorado president Hank Brown and Lynn Cheney, wife of the current vice president, back in 1995. Specifically to develop ways and means of bringing pressure to bear at institutions in order to change ideological framing. So they target people like me. There have been a number of others. Edward Said, for example, was heavily targeted by them. And the idea is to bring financial pressure to bear in a form of announcing back channel that you're going to withhold contributions until the problem of such and such a professor or such and such a department or such and such a curriculum sequence is resolved. And what they mean by resolution is make them go away and then we'll give you some money. Now, as I say, the president who was hired to make disposition of my case, Hank Brown, was, prior to being hired, the president and chief executive officer of something called the Daniels Fund. That's a billion-dollar slush fund for right-wing funding for this sort of thing in Colorado. And he was quoted in the newspaper about a month into my case to say he was personally withholding $400,000 in contributions from the Daniels Fund to the University of Colorado until the, quote, controversy was resolved. Then he was brought in, hired to make the resolution to his own satisfaction. Presumably, their cash flow has improved over the last couple, 3 weeks.
And it's interesting, University of Colorado is allegedly a public institution, but with the cuts in public funding, but in general, the idea that most deans of universities are just essentially pimps. Who are out there, right? I mean, the job is to raise money and to attract, and there's not a lot of wealthy left-wing indigenous donors, are there, that I know of?
Well, no, George Soros. Now you've exhausted the list, as far as I know, if you want to call George left.
Well, progressive, right?
And yeah, he is progressive.
And we got 1 minute, Ward, so why don't we end by saying this? We know that we need, if you think this is an amazing interview and you're just cosmic grasp, we want to get Ward to come out to L.A. and get a speaking engagement and have a university invite him as an honored guest in the Strategy Center, wanted to help put that together. So if you have ideas on that, if you want to make a contribution, if you want to continue this case, you're going to go to www.wardchurchill.net. And Ward, at this point, I'm gonna try to help some more. We're gonna get out of here because we got another show coming on.
All right, man.
Take good
care.
Thanks
for having me on.
So that ends today's program of Voices from the Front Lines. This is your host, Eric Mann. Thanks for joining us. We'd like to thank our guests today, Glenn Ford and Ward Churchill. You can listen to previous Voices shows at www.thestrategycenter.org. Send comments to voices@thestrategycenter.org. I'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, and Barry Bonds fan, production assistants Lisa Adler and Dehan Song, our engineer and musicologist, Maggie LaPeak. We'll see you next week for Voices from the Frontlines Radio, and up next, Beneath the Surface, with Susie Wiseman. We're out.